This podcast is brought to you by the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, your community foundation, which is focused on one simple goal: to help philanthropists pursue their causes for bettering the lives of people in Louisiana. Welcome to the pod. I'm your host, Chris Meyer, and today we invited in Chris Zonka, the Executive Director of the East Baton Rouge Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. We're going to talk today about the mission of the EBR-CJCC, how they started, and how they continue to fight for a justice system that's fair and equitable for all residents of East Baton Rouge Parish. Thanks to the work of the CJCC, EBR's nonviolent prison population has fallen by 43% since 2018. To learn more how they did that, keep listening. Chris, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, great to see you. So let's just get it out of the way. What is a CJCC and why is it important?
So the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council is a collaborative of justice, municipal, and community partners who are looking at ways to improve our local justice process and the justice system. We're looking to establish a system that's fair and equitable for everybody going through it. One that makes sure that the right people are in jail for the right reasons. We're also looking to establish a system that promotes and builds on public safety and making sure that the public is as safe as possible while we implement these improvements. And that's about it. I think that's it in a nutshell.
So this model, and I know you've got experience from across the country, you've come to Louisiana from Ohio. Where's it been done before, and what sort of success have we seen in other communities?
So CJCC's Criminal Justice Coordinating Councils exist all over the country. I don't know how many there are, but there are quite a few. Typically, they exist as a commission of government. We're a little different in that we're actually a 501c3. We're a nonprofit organization, which I like being because it doesn't make us more reliant to one of our board members because they're paying all our bills. The purpose is the same no matter where you go. Mm-hmm. It's to provide a platform and a foundation of collaboration around the local justice process there. And those people, whatever jurisdiction they're working in, are looking at their own particular processes and trying to make improvements in there. What comes out of that is this national network of criminal justice coordinating councils that all interact and talk and share, you know, successes or share failures so that others who are just attempting to do some of this stuff kind of have some of that information in hand when they're beginning these phases.
So I've had the chance to observe, you know, some of your meetings, and it's quite remarkable because around the table you've got judges, you've got public defenders, you've got the district attorney, you've got law enforcement, you've got community advocates. I mean, it's a room you wouldn't normally find all those together. And so I've got to think, you know, before the CJCC was created, I mean, what was the sort of justice framework? What did it look like? How were those groups sort of going forward in the community?
So many of those justice partners were doing really good things on their own, but they really just focused on their section of the justice process, the part that they touched, mm-hmm. and trying to make those improvements there, whether it was the police department, you know, trying to improve the way arrests are being made or how those charges are being done, or the DA's office or the sheriff's office, the judges, you know, during the court process. There was very little collaboration among the stakeholders to talk about what they're doing in their fields versus what they're doing in their agencies, to see where the overlap was and see where they could create efficiencies and create a more holistic approach to improving the justice process. That's what the CJCC provides, this comprehensive view of what's going on from the beginning to the end of the process, and having those discussions with all of the affected stakeholders and the people going through those, the community members, to talk about this process and if it's best for everyone going through it.
So give us a little history of maybe the origin story of the CJCC here. You know, I know we've been a recipient as a community of some national grants and others that have kind of highlighted both our efforts and success along the way. So how did it get started and how did you get here?
Well, I guess I have to lead with that the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, if not for their initiative and support in this process, the CJCC wouldn't be here, right?
Shameless plug.
It is a shameless plug, but it's well-deserved. BRAF recognized a need to improve our criminal justice system, and when they did that, they started bringing together these local justice stakeholders and sitting around a table. And out of that came this initiative to try to provide this kind of proof of concept, mm-hmm. that if we do get together and we do work together as a whole, then what can we do? How can we do it better than if we're doing it individually? Out of that came a pilot program called the Pretrial Diversion and Recovery Program. And that was cooperation with the Sheriff's Office, the police, the DA, the Public Defender's Office, and the courts. And what it did is it started to identify people who were incarcerated but also had behavioral health issues. And we have program staff for that. They would go in, they would assess them, and they would make sure they would fit into the program. We were looking for nonviolent offenders who would be better suited in treatment rather than in jail. And we started that program in 2018, and it's been a success ever since. And we've used that kind of as a catalyst, and I always refer back to that program because it still falls under the CJCC as, you know, the impetus behind how the CJCC was built, just bringing people together to talk, to say, hey, can we do this better? And we have. We've positively affected hundreds of lives since the program has begun. And now it's fully funded by the city parish because of the success the program's had.
Now, the use of sort of data and information among these different players to talk about systems and efficiencies and you know, again, how are we processing folks through the justice system appropriately? What have been some of the biggest wins and successes of CJCC so far?
Yeah, the wins are, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is just the collaboration, the level of collaboration. Before we implemented any programs or policy changes or any of these individual agencies made changes, we just sat around the table and talked and said, you know, how can we do this better? And just from that, going back to what you said at the beginning, you know, we've seen a 40% decline in our jail population over the last 5 years.
Wow.
And that's amazing. And if you look across the country, a lot of people have seen declines due to COVID and other things, but none of them at the level of which we have. And the other bonus to that is that we've maintained that post-COVID. We've maintained that reduction, and there has been no distinct spike back to the normal. So 40%, to put that in a people view, is that on any given day, 800 less people are in jail than they were 5 years ago. So we went from averaging about 2,000 people a day in custody to about 1,200, and we're maintaining that. And I think we still have room to move on.
Now, for those listeners that may, you know, have this next question of, now, wait a second, you know, we're lowering the jail population, but hasn't crime gone up in our community? Now, this was among nonviolent offenders. Help kind of tease that apart for us.
Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction to make, is that the people that are no longer in jail aren't the people that are committing these serious crimes. These are nonviolent, low-level felonies or misdemeanor charges that were typically everybody was arrested, and then they sorted them out later. Some of them got out. Some of them waited 3 months to hear that their charge wasn't billed.
3 months.
Yes. And it was an inefficient process, inefficient for both the person going through the process and for the agencies that were involved in the different parts of the process. Identifying these people as nonviolent, non-risk to public safety, and then making sure that they don't have to go to jail to hear their cases, and we still follow an efficient process through the justice process. I think that was the key. Just having those conversations was the key to the beginning of the decline of the jail population.
So justice is hopefully still served. It's done more efficiently. You haven't kind of in the interim, if somebody is, you know, sitting for 3 months to before they can even sort of be formally sort of billed into court, they haven't lost a job. They haven't sort of missed maybe, you know, a house payment or a rent payment. They certainly, you know, maybe haven't been pulled away from families. But importantly, as you say, this is not about you know, violent offenders, and y'all have been able to track this and sort of come back and combat any of those claims, right?
That's absolutely right. And everything you just said there is correct. I mean, there's numerous studies that show that as little as 24 hours in jail can disrupt somebody's lifestyle, in that they lose their job or their children might be taken away or they start losing connections to family and support members as the longer they stay in jail. So if we don't have to get them in jail and we know they're not a public safety risk and we can ensure that they're going to come back to court, doing so would wipe out all of that negative aspects of having to go to jail. And the process is the same either way, whether they're sitting in jail for it or they're not sitting in jail for it. They go through to adjudications.
So it still happens. I think that's just, you know, so important for folks to understand is it's not that anything about the justice process has stopped or changed. We are saving money, and we are hopefully, you know, not in the interim sort of making maybe, you know, one mistake much bigger for a wider family, a wider community, if it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So I know some of these wins have been pretty remarkable, and again, just the level of coordination that's you know, for the first time really happening among you know, different sides of this. I imagine those rooms, though, are not without some challenges, and certainly in the process to sort of have a more effective justice system in our community, there are still, I'm sure, many challenges on your board that you guys are working through. What are some of those that are still in front of us that you hope to tackle?
So, leadership turnover is usually a big challenge for us because our board itself consists of a lot of elected officials. Mm-hmm. Elected officials come and go, as we all know. Judges, you know, mayor, DA, sheriff. Luckily for us,
I think we elect dog catchers too.
But yeah, you know. Yeah, dog catchers. But luckily for us, we haven't seen a large turnover in the short amount of time CJCC has been operating. But we know it's going to come.
Yeah.
And being ahead of that, like when new judges come to the bench or elect to the bench, like we sit down with those judges individually for an hour and a half, and talk about the CJCC, what it's doing, so they have a full understanding of what this collaborative is. And we would do the same with all the other newly elected officials. Maintaining buy-in from stakeholders is a huge and never-ending kind of process for us. Like I consistently have to meet with people because our goals and our initiatives change as we complete one and we move on to the next one. So ensuring that we have this buy-in from the individual stakeholders to push this process, because without them, none of these changes would take place. And then the third thing that's always a challenge that we're working to overcome is ensuring that we are completely inclusive in our decision-making and our recommendations. And that means making sure that we have the community's voice and perspective involved in these conversations. We did that by creating CJCC Engage.
Yeah, let's talk more about that. How did that come about, and what sort of kind of feedback are you getting from community members as part of this process?
Well, Engage was committed as a subcommittee under CJCC, and the whole goal of that was to create a collaborative body of strictly community-based people. We have faith-based organization representatives, we have grassroots organizations, we have advocacy groups who all meet. We have over 50 people. We meet once a month, and all of these people come and discuss as the community perspective on the justice process and the things that they want to see done differently within the justice process. And it brings a whole new angle to that discussion. And I think that is one of the most important things we've done as a CJCC to include and make sure that community perspective in. On top of that, we've added two members from the Engage group to our CJCC board so that they can bring the voice and the perspective of the community to the board members that these discussions are taking place, but also ensure that what's happening on the board level, those discussions, all of that information goes back to the community. We're trying to be as transparent as possible when we're doing it.
So, you know, recently we have been under this wave. I know a lot of communities, you know, coming out of the pandemic, we've seen spikes in violent crime. We've seen spikes in murders, certainly gun arrest. And it's been pretty remarkable here in our own community. How has that conversation been treated in the CJCC? What are some of the early discussions about how we as a community can tackle this and nip it in the bud?
There's been a lot of discussion, especially with the community members, from the community members, about what they can do to help alleviate these crimes within their communities. I think a lot more of as we see it in the news, it's always the police chief or the sheriff or the DA who's answering the questions mm-hmm. about why this is happening. But a lot of the community members have their own take on why this is happening, and they live there. They want to be part of the solution to try to overcome it. And we've worked a lot as a CJCC to try to build this collaborative effort with these community members and the police and the sheriff and the people who are actually on the ground who want to make these changes and affect and make their neighborhoods better. And we'll continue to do that as long as the CJCC exists.
So what are some of the ideas and solutions that some of these community members are bringing about how they can better coordinate with law enforcement, with the justice system to help nip some of this in the bud?
Yeah, the community really wants to, and this isn't covered in the media a lot, but they really want to reconnect with law enforcement. The community members who want a better community to live in, they want to reconnect with the law enforcement that serves their neighborhoods and work with them to come up with solutions to make that, whether it's community policing or it's just educational processes that, you know, where people come in and talk, and whether it's bringing in trades or, you know, youth programs, those sorts of things. They want all of that, and they're willing to have those conversations and reconnect. I think there's been a disconnect in years between the police and the community, and I think that is, they're reforming that. And the police department and the sheriff's office and the DA's office is doing a really good job of being in the community to do that.
Well, I think especially coming out of, you know, again, the pandemic, it's such a great time to kind of reset a lot of these relationships. And certainly, you know, this is an area that, you know, it's necessary for the community to have justice in it and to build that. It's not the maybe the more hopeful side, but I certainly think from the coordination you've seen, we are getting to a place that it's more effective for our community, and we're getting, you know, safer. We're diverting tax, you know, payer resources, hopefully to things that matter much more to improve our community. Chris, as you kind of look on the horizon of the CJCC, and I know you're part of this national network of cities that are really on the cutting edge of data, on the cutting edge of conversations and strategies. What are maybe two or three big initiatives that you're hoping the CJC begins to take on in the coming years?
Yeah, I really feel like I need to mention that, and like you just alluded to, we are part of a national network called the Safety and Justice Challenge. Mm-hmm. East Baton Rouge Parish is one of over 50 sites that the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation has invested in as part of the Safety and Justice Challenge.
Yeah, selected us, right? That's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, they selected us, and it's been amazing being in that. With that comes connection with all of these other sites across the country who are doing what we're doing, and being able to discuss with them and do a lot of peer-to-peer. I can have my judge from here talk to their judge from there to talk about things that they're doing, or my sheriff talk to their sheriff. That's been great. And it's also been great that, you know, MacArthur's invested over $1 million into Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. Through this program for us to make some of these changes and provide a lot of these proof of concepts, which when we show that they work, they're taken on by the agencies that they're supporting because they see that it's work and it's become cost effective and it's become made their process more efficient. So that has allowed us to create programs like our rapid case assessment teams, a pretrial diversion and recovery program. Expedited Arraignment has worked and it continues to work. These programs, and I think we're focusing a lot more on, right now, the pretrial process. Mm-hmm. When you're arrested and charged with a crime and placed in jail, the very first time you show up in front of a judge, that judge decides what your bond amount is going to be. And that's usually an arbitrary monetary amount that's affixed to, you know, the level of the crime. If you don't have the means to pay that bond, you sit in jail for the entirety of your case. If you do have the means to pay that bond, you get out of jail, but still go through the criminal process. That means that people in poverty can't afford to be released from jail and lose everything and sit there, while people who aren't in poverty who may get arrested are able to be released. That has no bearing on public safety. It's just a matter of whether you can afford to or not. It's not a fair, efficient process. If we were to use some of these national tools that are out there that would do risk assessments to provide the judges an objective view of whether or not that person's a public safety risk, or what's the likelihood of that person returning to the court, rather than are they able to afford bond or not. Mm-hmm. That would make it a more fair and efficient process for the people in there. What we would see would be more, we'd see an increase in public safety because people with more violent bonds who can afford to bond won't be able to, because rather than money, it focuses on conditions of bond. And those conditions could be what keeps them in jail rather than the amount of money that needs to be posted. You'd also see people who aren't a public safety risk not sit in jail for, you know, a month or two before their case is resolved because they're not a public safety risk. And it's not about the money for them getting out. So I think that would be, that's our primary focus moving forward, is trying to ensure that system gets set up and gets put in place. There's many of them across the country that work very well. It'll reduce the jail population. it'll also promote public safety.
Well, that's a win-win combination, and I know you guys have been on the forefront of that. For folks who are thinking about ways to get involved with CJCC, how can they get involved? How can they help this important work?
Well, I talked about it earlier. Our CJCC Engage group, I think, would be the best way. We meet monthly at the Goodwood Library. And if you want to, if you're just a community member that wants to talk about the justice process, no matter what side of the fence that you sit on, you have a stake in the justice process because it affects you, your life, it affects your taxes. All of this is paid for by somebody. So if we can do it more efficiently and it costs less, hopefully it'll eventually cost them. I think coming to those meetings would be a good first step. And then working from there, we have subgroups that exist underneath them.
Well, it certainly is impressive that we are on the cutting edge now of coordination. We're becoming part of kind of a national movement that really is looking at, again, how do we improve public safety, make justice more fair, and frankly, more cost-effective for taxpayers. Chris, we're so grateful for the work you and the entire CJCC is doing, and I know you've got a great team and certainly a lot of amazing partners that are leaning in ways that they don't normally have to, but that's what's impressive. So thank you for all you do.
Well, thank you for having me, and yeah, I hope we keep up the good work.
For more information about the work of the EBR-CJCC, please visit ebrcjcc.org to learn more. As always, thank you for listening in. I'm your host, Chris Meyer, and our mission is to elevate the stories, people, and ideas making Baton Rouge a better place. To learn more about the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, please visit our website at braf.org and become a member today.